Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That was the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, David Burns, and the Rivertown Kids on the Grammy-winning Tomorrow's Children from Appleseed Records. Back again for another Soulotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We are in anticipation of the big march on New York City, on the United Nations for global warming, or shall we say against global warming. And they're expecting a very large crowd. I hope the weather's good. And there's a lot of activity going on. And to talk about that and a lot of other things are two people with us who are going to this march, people I've known for many, many decades. Of course, I met Harriet when she was 9 years old. But Harriet Barlow, of the Blue Mountain Center. Harriet, are you there? Hello, Harriet.
I'm here.
Okay, good, good, good. And you are in upstate New York right now, is that
you
right?
Bet. Headed for New York City.
Headed for New York City on the big, big march.
You
and
bet.
With you is your co-conspirator, David Morris. David, are you on the phone?
I am indeed. I am,
okay.
I am here also in upstate New York.
Two of the brightest and most committed and most influential people I've ever known, David Morris and Harriet Barlow. We're going to settle in for a really fine hour here of discussion, starting with the and David, you are the founder, and what is your title now of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance?
I am the director of the Public Good Initiative at the Institute.
The Public Good Initiative. So do you have like a Public Bad Initiative to balance what you do?
We have a number of different initiatives. This one is broader than many.
What is the Public Good Initiative? I can't let that one go by.
No, and why should you? Well, the Institute was set up in 1974, and the focus is on what cities can do, how we exercise local authority, and the focus has been on scale and ownership, that is, humanly scaled systems and distributed ownership. And in the last couple of years, it was pretty clear that it was hard to get to those issues if the narrative had been seized by those who believed in privatization and those who believed that, to quote Maggie Thatcher, there is no society and there is no connectivity with people and everyone is in it for themselves and that greed is the highest good. And so we started the Public Good Initiative to talk to people about how we are connected and that there is a need for equity and that there is a need for empathy.
So there really is a public bad initiative. It's by the corporations. And who was the one who said there was no society?
Maggie Thatcher.
Maggie Thatcher, my God.
Mm-hmm. She said there are only individuals and families. There is no society.
Whoa. Well, she can't come to my party. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, let's remember that her hero was Ronald Reagan and vice versa. And, of course, he said that government is not the solution, it's the problem.
Ah, Ronald Reagan. God, where is he? Of course, you know, Nancy Reagan's still alive, and Nancy Reagan is being widely credited by which I mean Kitty Kelly and Barbara Ehrenreich, of all people, with ending the Cold War. So I guess you never know about people, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. How'd she do that?
I don't know. I guess she and Mikhail Gorbachev went out for tea, and they just kind of said, oh, by the way, let's end the Cold War. And Nancy said, sure. And of course, Ronnie at the time was in with his early Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And so we've had two periods in our history when women have run the United States, individual women. One was Edith Wilson, who took over with when Woodrow was in a vegetative state, and she killed the League of Nations. But Nancy took over when Ronnie was in his vegetative state, and she, I guess, killed the Cold War. That's the general feeling. But you're saying that Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher had an affair? Is that what you're trying to tell us? All right. Enough of that. We don't want to visualize either. So let's talk about this big march coming up in New York City. Why are you two going to New York City, you brilliant, influential,
world-wise people? Why wouldn't anyone go who could crawl or walk or get there? I mean, this is the first opportunity in a long time for people, as the inheritors of the villainy of what you so aptly coin King Kong, to speak up and to be felt in mass and to say, you know, no, just no. No more extraction, no more freedom from liability, no more giving away the planet, no more ignorance of the impact on everyday people of what the oil, nuclear, gas, and what's the other one?
Actually, you want to go coal, oil, nukes, and gas. That's
there you go. There you go.
Coal, oil, nukes, and gas.
So, you know, so we're going down. We're going down to put our feet one in front of the other with a couple hundred thousand other people. And it's really astonishing to me that people are coming from all over the country. And David and I are, as we say delicately, of a certain age. I mean, we've been doing this work since the 60s, and there are a lot of people there who are planning to be there who are in their 20s or teens or 30s, and that's the really good thing. These are people who say, you know, this is our future. These are our kids. These are also, I have to say, our grandkids, and, you know, and I know you have some.
Yeah,
so,
I do.
You know, why would
nine.
We not be there would be the question.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I speak a lot, of course, on nukes. And the average age that comes out to hear me or maybe in general talk on nuclear power is well over 60.
Uh-huh.
But if you go to a fracking rally,
right?
Anti-fracking, they're in their 20s.
Yeah, but you know, it's
like
all one thing. It's all
one
thing. It's all the same people trying to do the same gathering up the dollars for their own pockets thing. And so we're not talking about different investors or different industries or different subsidies. We're talking about the same wrong path, and we're trying to get us off that wrong path onto a path that's about conservation and renewables and reuse and all of the values that we know will work and will get us to a sane and sustainable society.
All right, so tell us, David Morris and Harriet Barlow, what is it that you want? What is the ask here or the demand here of this march in New York City?
Well, David, why don't you talk about what you think the demand is, bottom line, for all of us?
Well, the demand of the march is that we switch from a non-sustainable to a sustainable energy resource. That's essentially the demand. And I think that, you know, the extension of that demand is that we stop allowing fossil fuel industries, which are, you know, the largest industries in the world in terms of the amount of money that they can mobilize, that we stop having them dictate a policy. You know, anybody who knows about the Koch brothers understands the power of concentrated wealth that comes from fossil fuels. So, it's interesting that you talked about nuclear and fracking and the different age groups. When we were the age that you're talking about, people in fracking, we were fighting a nuclear industry that was rapidly growing. I mean, it was feeling its oats in the late 1970s, and there was a movement that arose to essentially put a stop to it. And Three Mile Island and inflation and recession and a lot of different things did, but there wasn't. I don't think there's a nuclear reactor that has come online since the 1980s that wasn't commissioned in the 1970s. Essentially, you know, nuclear energy for all intents and purposes stopped as being the future of energy in the early 1980s, and now with fracking, you're seeing people declaring that that is the future of energy. And so there's people who are rising up and trying to make it stillborn, if you will, although I guess it can't be stillborn because it's already been given birth in a number of different places. But people saying, no, that isn't the future, and that if you continue in that direction, you're going to undermine the future that we really want.
Well, I'll go on with that.
I was very charmed to talk to a young person the other day on the phone about the march, and she said, I said, what do you think you're doing here? And she said, what are we doing? Why, we're switching from a focus on insanity to a focus on humanity. And I thought, that's simple enough. That's just fine. And then when the schedule for the march came in, I just pulled something up on my computer that I thought showed why this actually is going to succeed. And it's there are hundreds of events happening in relation to the march. And I'm just going to read just a couple to show the breadth, because in the morning of September 21st, before the official 11:30 start of the march, there is the Wall of Women's Action. There is the Global Youth Movement. There is the Bronx to Harlem for Climate Justice pre-march. There is the Catholic Mass for People's Climate March. There is Queer Planet with its pancake breakfast. There is the Dawn of the Anthropocene. You know, this is finally in our lifetime, I believe, people who come from many different points of self-interest realizing that everything that is wrong will be worse unless we pay attention to the climate crisis and understand the basic politics of the climate crisis, which is that a few people and corporations have their hands on the levers of power, and we have to take their hands off and put the people's hands on. Harvey?
Maybe we were dropped.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan.
Good.
Hello.
We're still here.
Okay, I guess we lost my internet connection. I'm going on the phone here, primitive style. I get it. My understanding is, and let me tell me if I'm completely wrong here, that the younger generation is counting on us geezers to knock off nuclear power while they move ahead with fossil fuels. Is that a fair assessment?
Knock off nuclear power? Is that what you said, Harvey?
Yes, for us to end the nuclear power industry while they take on the fossil fuel industry.
Well, I think that maybe, taking on the nuclear power industry is now much easier than it ever has been. Right? It's sort of pushing it over. It's tilting. Whereas fracking is something that is much more difficult to take on because it's in its kind of early teenage years. But I would, so I'm not sure that I would divide the labor between people over the age of 50 or 60 have to knock over nuclear power and people in the age of 30 have to take off of fracking. I think because in some ways, we're all on the same page when it comes to what the alternatives are. And it's really the alternatives that will spell the demise, of fracking and nuclear. If we were having this conversation, when the Institute for Local Self-Reliance founded it, started in 1974, in May of 1974, it was 2 months after SolarX, a company, began to produce for the first time solar cells for terrestrial applications. And so in that first year, there was enough solar cells produced to cover approximately a half of a house, although they weren't sold for household goods. And for household uses. And if we were having this conversation 10 or 15 years ago, we could talk about solar as something in the future. But in 2014, you're talking about solar as something in the present. And so it becomes a very different struggle in 2014 than it was in 1975 and 1980. The other issue is that electricity consumption has not increased in the last 15 years, and so it's been stable, and overall energy consumption has been going down. So we're in a perfect moment, really. Nuclear has priced itself out of the market, and of course we have to worry about terrorism attached to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And the alternatives have proven themselves viable, and now it's a matter of them not only scaling themselves up, but displacing the existing fossil fuel industry.
Well, I have written a piece, which I'm going to put out tonight.
You know what? You're a little bit echoing, Harvey.
Yeah,
so
it'll go away.
Okay.
Okay. So I have put out a piece, or I'm putting out a piece tonight, called Corporate Personhood is the Ebola Virus of Climate Chaos. my contention is that the real issue, the underlying issue of this march and of all our problems with the climate and with a lot of our other problems on this planet is corporate personhood, the power of corporations. And so, David, you're talking and very succinctly and articulately, as you always do, about the transition technologically. But we also need a transition in terms of the structure of the economy. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm going to answer. I'm going to just say that I think corporate personhood, with a bow to our deceased comrade Richard Grossman, who was the first person in my experience to raise this flag about what the impact of corporate personhood has been on the American democracy and economy. You know that we have some fundamental reforms that we have to work on. And corporate personhood is absolutely one of them, because it just lets the corporation off the hook every single time. And there are, thank goodness, amazing activists going state to state. They had their first vote in the Senate. It wasn't successful this last week.
But we did get a majority of the senators.
It was a great start.
We got a majority of the senators to at least want to debate corporate personhood.
Right. We just didn't get what we needed, but we got.
Right.
But it was a huge first step.
And of course, it got zero coverage.
Right. Right.
It's amazing.
Nobody
had
ever even heard the phrase or understood the implications of the phrase that corporations are the same as people, although they can't be executed. And I think we really need to keep that in mind.
Yes, the basic bumper sticker is that I'll believe corporations are people when Texas executes one.
Right, exactly.
So, but is there, do you think it would be a mistake? Let's put it that way. I actually may not be going to this march. We are waiting for our ninth grandchild. But
Congratulations.
I want to know if you, David and Morrison, Harriet Barlow, think that maybe this march should have a stronger focus on redoing or doing something about the structure of the corporation, as per Richard Grossman.
I didn't hear the last part of what you said.
As per Richard Grossman, our good buddy Richard Grossman raised this issue. People talk about capitalism now, but it's actually not capitalism in a way. It's monopoly capitalism or the power of corporations that are really the root cause of these problems. And maybe that should be a focus of the march. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly the power of corporations. I'm not sure that corporations as people, which is just, it's a bizarre notion to tell you the truth, and I'm not exactly clear what to do with it. It certainly is a powerful tool that the corporations now have. But there's a great deal that one can do if they are people or not people, frankly. And that's a matter of political will, but it certainly is true. I mean, when you sort of think about it, if you were an average citizen, and someone said to you, okay, I as a corporation can essentially set up a mailbox in the Bahamas and not pay any more taxes. Everything else is the same, but I just do that. And someone would say, well, wait, no, you shouldn't be able to do that. And the answer is, so how can you do that? And the answer is, well, because Congress lets me do that. And so there's a lot of things that corporations do parking, you know, what is it, $500 billion or more, you know, of money abroad, you know, simply because they want to avoid paying taxes and then not using it to create jobs here at home. I mean, so whether they're people or they're not people, the point is that one wants to be able to corral them and regulate them, and one can still do that. The problem is that if you allow money to control politics, and that's both corporations and very, 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 very rich people, it becomes extremely difficult to do that. But it isn't impossible. And yes, corporations essentially are the reason, the large-scale corporations are the reason that we have a serious problem in this country. But I would also say, I mean, I'm at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and we work a great deal with small business.
Hello?
Yeah.
Not, that's not on our side.
Okay.
That's on
not
your
mine
side.
Either, so, okay, well, we'll see what happens.
Well,
let's keep going.
One
yeah,
of
so
the things is that you know, there are people around the country now that are organizing.
Yeah, go ahead. You can talk over that.
David, check.
Check what?
Line one.
No, line one is...
Okay.
Okay, let's continue.
Okay.
So we always have little gremlins. It's part of the Soar-topian world is gremlins
okay.
on the phone lines. We have to do that just to keep things interesting. So
you have to say that the Soar-topian world will be just as reliable as the fossil fuel and the nuclear world without the terrorism as the downside.
Yes, there you go. Well, in Soar-topia, we will welcome our gremlins on the phone lines and and have them sit in our prayer circles at the end of our actions.
Excellent.
So there you go. So the there was criticism by Michael Lerner of this march, and you've pointed out that there is a tremendous number of activities going on beforehand. I mean, I looked at the schedule of the workshop at St. John's on Saturday, the day before the big march, and it looks like going back to the university. What happens after the march? That's what Michael Lerner wanted to know. What where is the next step? Where are the organizing seminars? And do we go to civil disobedience?
Let me just remind you about the No Nukes concerts. You know, because back in the day when you were organizing with others. Musicians to speak out and to create public consciousness about nuclear power. People said, well, yeah, what is this going to add up to? Well, you know what it added up to was consciousness and determination. People got the spirit. They got the spirit, and that inspired them to get more information. And when they got more information, they got more energy, and they applied that energy to real citizenship. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen here.
Is there a big rally at the end of this march? Is there
well, that
are
was
people
the problem
speaking?
Of the relationship to the police department of New York City, that the city refused to give a permit that would allow the planners to have a central ending space where they would be able to mobilize everyone. I mean, it's been a living nightmare for all of them because they. Of course, this is all catalyzed by the UN conference on climate. They were not allowed to go anywhere near the UN or UN Plaza. They tried for Times Square. They tried for Central Park. They tried for a number of other venues, and they were not able to get a place. So what they have done is to make a silk purse out of really a lot of kind of tired old sow's ears, and they're doing, I think, a really interesting thing and a unique thing, which is they're making something that perhaps the Catholic members of your audience might remember as the Stations of the Cross, many different places where issues and opportunities are going to be evident as they walk along instead of there being only one cumulative experience at the end. And I admire these young organizers. I mean, I think there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears about trying to get a march route and a rallying point, and they couldn't get what they wanted, and they've made something pretty darn good out of what they could get.
So nobody, we're not gathering in Central Park or
no,
Times
wouldn't
Square
let them.
Or Madison Square Garden at the end of this
They wouldn't
march?
Let them.
That's amazing.
I know, but
well,
they
course,
do have,
well,
they have 6th Avenue, and they have a long, well, they have 6th Avenue to 11th Avenue on 42nd Street, and that's a pretty good venue. And it's they're closing off 42nd Street, and there are going to be a lot of opportunities for people to gather. And then there's the organization called Now Beautiful Trouble is doing this amazing public installation on 11th Avenue at the end of the march, which is a ribbon, a kind of a river of ribbon of concerns of citizens. And there's going to be a gathering around that. And, you know, I think people of the scores of organizations that have been planning this don't think of this as an end. They think of this as an expression. And they think that the people who are coming today are primed to carry on and are looking to each other to learn more about how to carry on. And that's an exciting and beautiful thing. And it's a cross-generational thing. It's a cross-racial thing. There's just a lot of energy around the time factor and realizing we have to do what we need to do now, not a generation from now.
That's interesting. The last march I went to that did not have a permit for an ending point was the Chicago Democratic Convention in 1968, and we all know how that turned out.
Uh-huh.
So, but I guess people are a little less rambunctious at this point than we were during the middle of the war in Vietnam. We're talking with Harriet Barlow of the Blue Mountain Center in New York and David Morris, the good guy at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, one of the founders of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. They are going to New York this weekend to march about global warming at the UN and to make a point about the transition we need from renewables to King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to renewables. I wonder if that King Kong thing is actually going to catch on. I put it in my book, Solartopia, 10 years ago, and it's sort of slowly getting a little cachet. There was a beautiful poster done with King Kong on top of the Empire State Building there that I really like by a woman named Gail Payne. So we'll see what happens with that. Of course, in the movie, there have been three movies about King Kong, and they've gotten progressively worse. but in all of them, he turns out to be kind of a sympathetic figure. I'm not looking for that from the coal, oil, nukes, and gas industry. So Bill McKibben is one of the leaders of this. I assume you guys work with Bill McKibben over the years.
Yep.
And but I assumed that he would be a speaker at a major rally at the end of this march, and I guess that's not going to be the case. Is that right?
Well, you know, here are two interesting things. One is that Bill wrote a terrific piece, I thought, about a year ago, saying that if this movement is to succeed, it has to be a leaderless movement in the sense that there can't be any one person who is primarily identified with it. And I think this is true. And I think, you know, in America, we don't pay a lot of attention to people who are doing work outside the United States, but there are hundreds of leaders around the world. Some of them come out of the peasant class, some of them come out of the working class, some of them come out of the I wish I had work class, but there are people all over the world who are devoting themselves to trying to rally people's awareness about the dangers and the opportunities to avoid the dangers. And I really take my hat off to Bill. I mean, he's still relentless and effort and full of effort about the clarion call for all of us to pay attention. But I think his core point, which is this is every human being's issue. This is not something that a few people can carry forward. Every one of us has to understand that the future of the planet will be altered for the foreseeable in ways we cannot even imagine if we don't pay attention now and switch to renewables and rethink our economic policies to for a new economy, which is a lot of what the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is about, is realizing a new economy based on this principle.
Well, let's take a short break with Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version, and we're going to talk about more about rethinking the corporation, because I'm wondering if that's getting enough attention at this march. And I also really want to talk about Scotland, especially since I saw Stephen Colbert with a kilt on the other night. So we're with David Morris and Harriet Barlow. We'll be back in 3 minutes after the Solartopia Rocky song with my good buddy Dana Lyons.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
Okay, lots of forest for the bears. That's my good buddy, Dana. Cows with Guns, Lyons. Cows with Guns, over 2 million hits on the internet, YouTube. What a great song. What a great guy. I love Dana Lyons. And we're back with two other people I love, Harriet Barlow and David Morris, talking about the big march in New York City. But before we do, I know we're going to get deep into it, and I'm not going to want to break. So I want to cover this now. Scotland. Scotland is about to vote on independence. And David, you wrote a really interesting, beautiful, brilliant piece, as always, about the independence of Scotland. Tell us about this vote. And one thing, Stephen Colbert did his usual hilarious piece on Scotland. And he said that if Scotland votes for independence, the Prime Minister of England, David Cameron, who's a real world-class jerk, will have to resign. Is that true? And let's jump in on that.
No. It's probably not true. Let's just put it this way. But it's fascinating to watch the dynamics, actually. I mean, let's understand. You know, Scotland's 5 million people, it could make it on its own. It could probably make it on its own relatively well. But the primary reason, besides 307 years of upsetness, if you will, the primary reason that has come to a head now is that Scotland marches to a different drummer in terms of its sense of society. And, you know, Cameron is a disciple of Maggie Thatcher, and Cameron does, in fact, believe that people are not connected with each other. And he has privatized the health system, and he has privatized and he has sold assets. And the Scottish believe in communitarianism. They believe that they are connected. They believe in society. They want to raise the minimum wage. He wants to reduce the minimum wage. They want to increase the safety net. He's rending the safety net. They believe that immigration is perfectly acceptable. He wants to end immigration. So it's a completely different set of values, and the Scottish have their own parliament. It's relatively recent, but they have their own parliament. And their parliament and their representatives to the British Parliament are essentially all nationalists. So, you know, what you have at the present time is a part of the United Kingdom which has voted overwhelmingly for a different set of social policies and values than has the mother country. And the question right now is whether the mother country can give Scotland sufficient autonomy to ward off what appears to be a possible vote, a majority in favor of independence. And I don't know if you've been tracking it or your listeners have been tracking it the last few days, but it's an astonishing situation. I don't think it's ever occurred before, where you literally have the head of a nation who is throwing things at these 5 million people of that nation to try to keep them in. Yesterday he said that they could tax themselves, that they could have control over their own tax revenue and tax policy, which is an astonishing concession by a British prime minister. I mean, essentially, 3 days ago he tried to raise the Scottish flag over Whitehall, but there was a bit of a problem and it fell off, which was an incredible sight, to tell you the truth. But, you know, that's what's going on right now, and we don't know. The independence vote is going to be extremely close, but it's not a vote at a peak. It's a vote because a certain part of the United Kingdom has said we do not believe in what we consider the mean and inhumane policies of the government in Whitehall, and we do not apparently have any ability to stop that from happening. So we want to go our own way and be able to create our own social policy.
Wow, I love that. I mean, I think it's a great thing. I do really hope that they vote for secession. Stephen Colbert said that he was surprised that Scotland was voting to secede because he didn't know they had slaves. I thought that was really funny. But anyway.
John Oliver, by the way, has an even better piece on it, which people should go, of course, to the to the YouTube and see the John Oliver piece from last Sunday. Now, of course, John Oliver is English, and uh-huh. So it's an Englishman's presentation on Scotland, and it's very funny, but it's also very balanced. I mean, you have a sense in some ways that John Oliver would prefer that they stay, but he understands why it might be that they will leave. But there's another thing related to Scotland that I think it's important for people to understand, and that is that since the end of World War II, we've had two waves of nation creation, if you will. The first was the decolonization movement in the 60s and the 70s, and the second was the breakup of Russia and Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. And so the number of nations in the world has increased from around 60 to around 180 during that time period. And if Scotland votes for independence, it's not inconceivable, in fact, it's likely that we will see the next wave, and the next wave will be existing nations beginning to break down. And it's one reason that Europe, for example, is terrified at what could happen, because if Scotland votes for independence, Flanders would probably vote for independence from Belgium. Certainly Catalonia and the Basque provinces will vote for independence from Spain, and of course there's Wales in terms of the United Kingdom, and there's Britain in terms of France. And so there really could be a dynamic for a breakdown of nations into even smaller units.
And don't forget Vermont.
Right, and Martha's Vineyard, for God's sake.
And Martha's Vineyard, for heaven's sake, yeah.
I mean, I think actually David Morris and Harriet Barlow, there should be a global law that no nation, no country, can be bigger than 5 million people.
Well, there you
how
go.
How would that work? I mean, you'd have to divide up Ohio into two states. California California would be six countries. I think that would be perfectly fine.
Well, I think
you?
It's all about bioregions. I think you've got to align people and bioregions, and then maybe yes.
You know, one of the things is that when you look at Scotland, and by the way, Scotland has gone through in the last 6 months a remarkable period of debate, internal debate, as only the Scots will. I mean, the Scottish Enlightenment in the 18th century was a wondrous, wondrous elevation of a world based on witchcraft to a world based on reason. And they really have debated it. And how they come out on the other end, you know, we don't know. But they really have, in fact, debated it. And so there's a lot of things on the table. And one of the things on the table is that Scotland is the home of the British nuclear weapons. And if they become independent, they have already declared that they want those things off their territory. The other thing is that if you wanted to figure out how to be able to take care of your people, it would probably mean eliminating your military budget. And so Scotland may very well have deep cuts in their military budget. Now, they can do that because it doesn't appear that they're going to be invaded by England, and it doesn't appear that England would allow them to be invaded by Iceland. And so, you know, they can get to do that. But it's those kinds of things that really people don't think about in terms of your ability to radically transform not only the way you tax, but the way you spend.
Well, I don't know, man. I've been watching that series on the Vikings, and if I was Scotland, I'd be really worried.
Hey, by the way, I come from Minneapolis, and when you say Vikings, you know, we don't think that you mean somebody in northern Europe.
Yeah, well, I think tell us the title of your piece. It was really, really good on Scotland, and I think people should read it.
Well, people can go on Alternet and just David Morris in Scotland.
Okay.
Or they can go on Common Dreams or Huffington Post. It's actually in a lot of different places. In the last few days, it was published.
Well, good. Well, I hope they read it in Scotland as well. That would be nice. Now, Paul Krugman wrote a piece sort of warning the Scots that they'll go bankrupt if they secede, but, you know, usually he's pretty sensible.
Well, I mean, he's an economist, but essentially the two things about Scotland are, number one, will they be able to continue adopting the British pound? And the British have said, not on your life. And so if they don't do that, then they can have their own currency, but they can peg it to the British pound. And so it is. It's not, you know, it's not that they're going to go broke. They're going to peg it to the British pound, just the same way as Argentina pegged their Argentina dollar. In fact, they called it a dollar to the U.S. dollar, so they could do that. I understand what, you know, where he's coming from an economist standpoint. But this is one of those times where he really needs to put down his calculator and think about what people's values are.
Right. I think they could peg their currency to either the price of kilts or to Scotch whiskey. That would be a much better basis than.
I think
than the
latter will
British
have
pound.
A broader appeal.
Well, there's another thing about Scotland. The president of Europe, who by the way happens to be a Spaniard, so you have to take that into consideration, has said that if the Scots vote for independence, they will not be permitted to come into Europe. Because as the head of Spain, although he's acting on behalf of the entire European Union, he's worried about Spain breaking down. But if you can imagine how European Union would say, look, we can countenance possibly bringing in Turkey, but we can't figure out how we can bring, but we're not going to allow Scotland to come in. It's an impossibility that they could do that. But he announced it 6 or 8 months ago, that Scotland would not be permitted to come into the European Union.
Oh, well, what the heck, you know. Oh, but Scots people can come. They can visit. They're not going to stand at the border and say, if you're from Scotland, you can't visit. Okay. All right, we're talking with David Morris and Harriet Barlow. We just covered the issue of Scotland. I really hope that they do secede. I think you're right. There's a tremendous need in this world to have smaller countries. I mean, the smaller countries, you look at Sweden, Denmark, you know, Norway, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, these are the saner countries. It's the big countries, the United States, Indonesia, China, India, that are completely whacked out. And, you know, that's I'm all for smaller countries, and I hope this happens. And if it does, I'm going to find a nice island to move to and try and get it to secede from wherever it is. that's my next
project.
Well,
you know, as I wrote in that piece that you were talking about, if Scotland does declare its independence, it then has to deal with the fact that it is not, in fact, as sovereign as it would hope to be. And the reason for that is these corporations that you talk about, that these corporations will still be dominant in the world, and they've created rules, global rules, that allow them to do with impunity things that we wouldn't prefer that they do. And so if Scotland, for example, gains its independence and then decides to seize the assets of a corporation, then it will be taken to a world court, and a world court will not be made up of judges per se. They will be made up of corporate lawyers, and so, you know, it will have to deal with the real world. But the Scottish have been ingenious in the past, and the presumption is that they will be able to figure out what to do, you know, about that. And as you said, if you go to Scotland and you look north, all of the countries are about the same size. If you go to Scotland and you look south, most of the countries are larger than it. And so the question is, will it look north or will it look south? And presumably the countries to the north of it would help enormously in helping it out. When Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, you know, gained their independence and European Union started. Finland and Denver and Sweden and Norway and Denmark and the like, they created their own trade federation, which allowed them a great deal of sovereignty, but also allowed them in some ways as a leverage against the larger European Union and prevented their having to join the European Union. And I would imagine that Scotland could probably join, you know, with that group if it wasn't allowed to join with the European Union. But it's a dynamic, you know, larger nations breaking down into smaller nations is a dynamic that's been going on now for about 70 years, and, you know, we can expect that it will continue.
I'd also like to point out that if you pay attention to trade agreements, which we all should pay more attention to, because they are the vehicle by which corporations are usurping national democratic processes, it is often the smaller countries. I would hold up Bolivia, which has, I believe, about 10 million people, which has been the voice that has stopped many of the most egregious corporate influenced trade policies, because they just say no, and the smaller countries can say no. And we should be very grateful for that. And, you know, we hope maybe some of these smaller countries, which have a sense of their people and their people's interest, will continue to be the safeguard against the larger countries that have been taken over by, such as the United States, I'm sorry to have to say, by corporate influence.
I think you should get down there and change the theme of this march to add a new slogan: more smaller countries.
Yeah.
And we should call it the Grand Fenwick Alliance, from the Mouse That Roared. Remember that
there
country?
There you go.
That,
write a
Grand,
book
Grand
about
Fenwick
it.
Less is more. More is less.
So let's talk about that then. We're actually, that was a beautiful discussion. Thank you. I really wanted to have that with you, especially David, after reading your fabulous piece on Scotland. And I'm sure when they vote, hopefully on Thursday, to secede, that you'll write a brilliant follow-up. So let's talk to you. You mentioned the corporations. My new piece coming out tomorrow will be called The Corporations or Corporate Personhood is the Ebola Virus of Climate Chaos.
Whoa.
What do we do about the power of the corporations, and how can this march in New York get us further down the road or up the road?
Well, we have a national movement, as I know you know, on corporate personhood, and there are many city councils and now a number of states that have said that they realize the danger of corporate personhood, and that was, you know, part of what motivated the leaders in the Senate to try and raise that flag. I mean, I think this is a movement. I think that it's only part of the problem, but it's something that people should just say, what? This is ridiculous, and just strike it down. And the idea that it has to be a constitutional amendment is ridiculous. David has always said, you know, we should have a simple constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech. And I think
those
two things need to be understood in relation to each other.
I think also, Harvey, you know, the question is, what do we do at the meta level, which is the constitutional amendment, and what do you deal with this, how you deal with the Supreme Court decisions? But then there's, what do we do at the state level? And for example, you know, Walmart dominates the brick and mortar retail sector. Amazon dominates, you know, the online, you know, commerce, you know, sector. I mean, you can go, you know, place by place within the economy, and you can find one or two corporations, you know, Comcast in terms of cable, so forth, and we can tackle them. I mean, we can tackle them. We can tackle them on the state level. Sometimes even we can tackle them on the local level. There's a number of cities. There's 150 cities now in the United States that have built their own telecommunications networks, high-speed fiber networks, the best in the world. They've built, and having built those networks, they begin to compete with Comcast. And in some cases, they're competing with them extremely well. And so, you know, there's a way to do this. It's not easy by any means, but there's a way to challenge them, if you will, from the bottom up, while at the same time trying to work at the higher levels to stop them from preempting what's going on at the at the lower levels. An example of that is that, you know, states are not permitted by Congress essentially to impose a sales tax on Amazon's sales. And the only reason that Amazon got to be Amazon because essentially it had a 6 to 9% advantage off your against your independent bookstores and your independent everything else right off the bat in terms of not paying the sales tax. And so if we could say to Congress, hey, you believe in states' rights, right, all you Republicans? Well, good. Well, then let states do this. You know, then you begin to, you know, to regain some footing, you know, around that. So there's a lot of things that can be done. Credit unions are growing fast compared to banks. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done. One shouldn't be Pollyannish about it. And while one creates the new institutions, one also has to curb the power of the old institutions. But it's not just having to curb the power of the old institutions.
Very interesting. Now, I was told last week on our show by an expert from freepress.net that there are state laws against communities setting up their own internet networks. Is that true?
Yes, there are 19 states that have done that. I mean, essentially what happened, you know, it's interesting that if you ask, the Comcast, the Time Warners, the Verizons of the world, they will explain to you that the reason that they're opposed to cities owning their own telecommunications networks is because government is incapable of doing that. They're inefficient, and the taxpayer is going to end up having to bail them out. But in fact, they didn't start lobbying legislatures to prevent cities from doing this until the cities were successful. It was only when they were successful at building these systems and proving they could be competitive that the telecom companies went to their legislatures and prevented anyone else from replicating them. So there are 19 states. There are 4 states that ban outright cities from having anything to do with telecommunications networks, and there are 15 others that put a severe barriers and obstacles in their way.
Unbelievable. We've been talking with David Morris of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and Harriet Barlow from the Blue Mountain Center. We did talk a bit about Scotland. I want to go back to that really quickly, David, and remind you when you write your celebratory piece for Scottish independence that the term hillbilly actually comes from Scotland. In 1680, do you know this?
No, I did not.
In 1688, King James II wanted to take Scotland and the Great Britain, as it were, back to the Catholic Church after all those years of Henry having formed the Anglican Church. And James II let it be known he wanted to go with Rome, and the people of England they wanted none of it. And they rose up, and they forced him to leave. He threw the royal signet into the Thames River. But as he was leaving, the people of Scotland were particularly fierce, and they wanted a new king to come in, King William of Orange, who was known as King Billy. And it was said that the Scottish people came down from the hills for King Billy and therefore became hillbillies. So there you go.
That's a great story.
It's a wonderful story. The glorious revolution of 1688, mm-hmm. It was called. And when William came in, he was forced to accept the first real Bill of Rights in Western society. David and Harriet, give us your websites and how to get a hold of you for our listeners.
David?
Well, it's ilsr.org. We'll get you to our website, and through the website you can get to the Public Good Initiative and you can get to me personally.
And I hope that those of you who care about social justice and the integration of issues to make the movement we need to win will think about using the Blue Mountain Center, which is BMC at BlueMountainCenter.org.
Well, I've been to Blue Mountain. It was many, many years ago.
It was.
I met some truly wonderful people there, and it's about as beautiful a place as there is on this earth. And you two people are just a joy to be with. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It was wonderful to be with you again.
We are We are pulling for a huge turnout in New York and for a great event and for the beginning of the end of corporate personhood and the death of King Kong.
King Kong.
All
right.
For your good
and
work.
The birth of Solartopia. Coal,
fun.
Oil, nukes,
thank
and
you.
Gas giving way.
Okay.
Thank you both
Bye-bye.
So much. And thank you all for listening to another wonderful show with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. Thank you in New York. And we'll hear you next week on the radio.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.